The miller wakes up when the soporific drone of the mill wheel is interrupted. He listened to what Langeron said, as if remarking, "So you are still at that silly business," quickly closed his eye again and let his head sink still lower. Langeron, trying as virulently as possible to sting Weyrother's vanity as author of the military plan, argued that Bonaparte might easily attack instead of being attacked, and so render the whole of this plan perfectly worthless. Weyrother met all objections with a firm and contemptuous smile, evidently prepared beforehand to meet all objections, be they what they might. "If he could attack us, he would have done so today," said he. "So, you think he is powerless?" said Langeron. "He has 40,000 men at most," replied Weyrother, with the smile of a doctor to whom an old wife wishes to explain the treatment of a case. "In that case, he is inviting his doom by awaiting our attack," said Langeron, with a subtly ironical smile, again glancing round for support to Miloradovich, who was near him. But Miloradovich was at that moment evidently thinking of anything rather than of what the generals were disputing about. "Ma foi," said he, "tomorrow we shall see all that on the battlefield." Weyrother again gave that smile which seemed to say that to him it was strange and ridiculous to meet objections from Russian generals, and to have to prove to them what he had not merely convinced himself of, but had also convinced the sovereign emperors of. "The enemy has quenched his fires, and a continual noise is heard from his camp," said he. "What does that mean? Either he is retreating, which is the only thing we need fear, or he is changing his position," he smiled ironically. "But even if he also took up a position in the Tuarasa, he merely saves us a great deal of trouble, and all our arrangements to the minutest detail remain the same." "How is that?" began Prince Andrei, who had for long been waiting an opportunity to express his doubts. Kutuzov here woke up, coughed heavily, and looked round at the generals. "Gentlemen, the dispositions for tomorrow, or rather for today, for it is past midnight, cannot now be altered," said he. "You have heard them, and we shall all do our duty. But before a battle, there is nothing more important," he paused, "than to have a good sleep." He moved as if to rise. The generals bowed and retired. It was past midnight. Prince Andrei went out. The council of war at which Prince Andrei had not been able to express his opinion, as he had hoped to, left on him a vague and uneasy impression. Whether Dolgorukov and Weyrother, or Kutuzov, Langeron, the others who did not approve of the plan of attack, were right, he did not know. But was it really not possible for Kutuzov to state his views plainly to the emperor? Is it possible that on account of court and personal considerations, tens of thousands of lives, and my life, he thought, must be risked? "Yes, it is very likely that I shall be killed tomorrow," he thought. And suddenly, at this thought of death, a whole series of most distant, most intimate memories rose in his imagination. He remembered his last parting from his father and his wife. He remembered the days when he first loved her. He thought of her pregnancy and felt sorry for her and for himself, and in a nervously emotional and softened mood, he went out of the hut in which he was billeted with Nesvitsky and began to walk up and down before it. The night was foggy, and through the fog the moonlight gleamed mysteriously. "Yes, tomorrow, tomorrow," he thought. "Tomorrow everything may be over for me. All these memories will be no more. None of them will have any meaning for me. Tomorrow, perhaps, even certainly, I have a presentiment that for the first time I shall have to show all I can do." And his fancy pictured the battle, its loss, the concentration of fighting at one point, and the hesitation of all the commanders. And then that happy moment, that Toulon, for which he had so long waited, presents itself to him at last. He firmly and clearly expresses his opinion to Kutuzov, to Weyrother, and to the emperors. All are struck by the justness of his views, but no one undertakes to carry them out. So he takes a regiment, a division, stipulates that no one is to interfere with his arrangements, leads his division to the decisive point, and gains the victory alone. But death and suffering? Suggested another voice. Prince Andrei, however, did not answer that voice, and went on dreaming of his triumphs. The dispositions for the next battle are planned by him alone. Nominally, he is only an adjutant on Kutuzov's staff, but he does everything alone. The next battle is won by him alone. Kutuzov is removed, and he is appointed. Well, and then? Asked the other voice. If before that you are not 10 times wounded, killed, or betrayed, well, what then? Well, then, Prince Andrei answered himself, I don't know what will happen, and I don't want to know, and can't. But if I want this, want glory, want to be known to men, want to be loved by them, it is not my fault that I want it, and want nothing but that, and live only for that, yes, for that alone. I shall never tell anyone, but, oh God, what am I to do if I love nothing but fame and men's esteem? Death, wounds, the loss of family, I fear nothing. And precious and dear as many persons are to me, father, sister, wife, those dearest to me, yet dreadful and unnatural as it seems, I would give them all at once for a moment of glory, of triumph over men, of love of men I don't know and never shall know. For the love of these men here, he thought, as he listened to voices in Kutuzov's courtyard. The voices were those of the orderlies who were packing up. One voice, probably a coachman's, was teasing Kutuzov's old cook, whom Prince Andrei knew, and who was called Tit. He was saying, Tit, I say, Tit. Well, returned the old man. Go, Tit, thresh a bit, said the wag. Oh, go to the devil, called out a voice, drowned by the laughter of the orderlies and servants. All the same, I love and value nothing but triumph over them all. I value this mystic power and glory that is floating here above me in this mist. Chapter 13. Rostov at the Front. Napoleon's Proclamation. That same night, Rostov was with a platoon on skirmishing duty in front of Bagration's detachment. His hussars were placed along the line in couples, and he himself rode along the line trying to master the sleepiness that kept coming over him. An enormous space, with our army's campfires dimly glowing in the fog, could be seen behind him. In front of him was misty darkness. Rostov could see nothing, peer as he would into that foggy distance. Now something gleamed grey, now there was something black, now little light seemed to glimmer where the enemy ought to be, now he fancied it was only something in his own eyes. His eyes kept closing, and in his fancy appeared now the Emperor, now Denisov, and now Moscow memories, and he again hurriedly opened his eyes and saw close before him the head and ears of the horse he was riding, and sometimes, when he came within 6 paces of them, the black figures of hussars, but in the distance was still the same misty darkness. Why not? It might easily happen, thought Rostov, that the Emperor will meet me and give me an order, as he would to any other officer. He'll say, "Go and find out what's there." There are many stories of his getting to know an officer in just such a chance way and attaching him to himself. What if he gave me a place near him? Oh, how I would guard him! How I would tell him the truth! How I would unmask his deceivers! And in order to realize vividly his love and devotion to the sovereign, Rostov pictured to himself an enemy or a deceitful German whom he would not only kill with pleasure, but whom he would slap in the face before the Emperor. Suddenly, a distant shout aroused him. He started and opened his eyes. Where am I? Oh, yes, in the skirmishing line. Pass and watchword, Schaft, Olmütz. What a nuisance that our squadron will be in reserve tomorrow, he thought. I'll ask leave to go to the front. This may be my only chance of seeing the Emperor. It won't be long now before I'm off duty. I'll take another turn, and when I get back, I'll go to the General and ask him." He readjusted himself in the saddle and touched up his horse to ride once more round his hussars. It seemed to him that it was getting lighter. To the left he saw a sloping descent lit up, and facing it a black knoll that seemed as steep as a wall. On this knoll there was a white patch that Rostóv could not at all make out. Was it a glade in the wood lit up by the moon, or some unmelted snow, or some white houses? He even thought something moved on that white spot. "I expect it's snow, that spot. A spot in Tash," he thought. "There now, it's not a Tash. Natasha, sister, black eyes. Natasha. Won't she be surprised when I tell her how I've seen the Emperor? Natasha. Take my sabre, Tash."
"Keep to the right, Your Honour. There are bushes here,"
came the voice of an hussar, past whom Rostóv was riding in the act of falling asleep. Rostóv lifted his head that had sunk almost to his horse's mane and pulled up beside the hussar. He was succumbing to irresistible, youthful, childish drowsiness. "But what was I thinking? I mustn't forget. How shall I speak to the Emperor? No, that's not it. That's tomorrow. Oh, yes. Natasha, sabre Tash. Sabre them. Whom? The hussars.
Ah, the hussars with moustaches. Along the Tverskaya Street rode the hussar with moustaches. I thought about him, too, just opposite Guriev's house. Old Guriev. Oh, but Denisov's a fine fellow. But that's all nonsense. The chief thing is that the Emperor is here. How he looked at me and wished to say something, but dared not. No, it was I who dared not. But that's nonsense. The chief thing is not to forget the important thing I was thinking of. Yes, Natasha, sabre Tash. Oh, yes, yes, that's right." And his head once more sank to his horse's neck. All at once it seemed to him that he was being fired at. What? Cut them down, what?" said Rostóv, waking up. At the moment he opened his eyes, he heard in front of him, where the enemy was, the long-drawn shouts of thousands of voices. His horse and the horse of the hussar near him pricked their ears at these shouts. Over there, where the shouting came from, a fire flared up and went out again, then another, and all along the French line on the hill fires flared up and the shouting grew louder and louder. Rostóv could hear the sound of French words, but could not distinguish them. The din of many voices was too great. All he could hear was "ah" and "rrr".
"What's that? What do you make of it?" said Rostóv to the hussar beside him. "That must be the enemy's camp." The hussar did not reply. "Why, don't you hear it?" Rostóv asked again, after waiting for a reply.
"Who can tell, Your Honour?" replied the hussar reluctantly.
"From the direction, it must be the enemy," repeated Rostóv.
"It may be he, or it may be nothing," muttered the hussar. "It's dark. Steady," he cried to his fidgeting horse.
Rostov's horse was also getting restive. It pawed the frozen ground, pricking its ears at the noise and looking at the lights. The shouting grew still louder and merged into a general roar that only an army of several thousand men could produce. The lights spread farther and farther, probably along the line of the French camp. Rostóv no longer wanted to sleep. The gay, triumphant shouting of the enemy army had a stimulating effect on him. "Vive l'Empereur! L'Empereur!" he now heard distinctly. "They can't be far off, probably just beyond the stream," he said to the hussar beside him. The hussar only sighed without replying and coughed angrily. The sound of horses' hoofs approaching at a trot along the line of hussars was heard, and out of the foggy darkness the figure of a sergeant of hussars suddenly appeared, looming huge as an elephant.
"Your Honour, the generals," said the sergeant, riding up to Rostóv.
Rostóv, still looking round toward the fires and the shouts, rode with the sergeant to meet some mounted men who were riding along the line. One was on a white horse.
Prince Bagration and Prince Dolgorukov with their adjutants had come to witness the curious phenomenon of the lights and shouts in the enemy's camp. Rostov rode up to Bagration, reported to him, and then joined the adjutants listening to what the generals were saying. "Believe me," said Prince Dolgorukov, addressing Bagration, "it is nothing but a trick. He has retreated and ordered the rear guard to kindle fires and make a noise to deceive us."
"Hardly," said Bagration. "I saw them this evening on that knoll. If they had retreated, they would have withdrawn from that too."
"Officer," said Bagration to Rostov, "are the enemy's skirmishers still there?"
"They were there this evening, but now I don't know, Your Excellency. Shall I go with some of my hussars to see?" replied Rostov.
Bagration stopped, and before replying tried to see Rostov's face in the mist.
"Well, go and see," he said after a pause.
"Yes, sir."
Rostov spurred his horse, called to Sergeant Fedchenko and two other hussars, told them to follow him, and trotted downhill in the direction from which the shouting came. He felt both frightened and pleased to be riding alone with three hussars into that mysterious and dangerous misty distance where no one had been before him. Bagration called to him from the hill not to go beyond the stream, but Rostov pretended not to hear him and did not stop, but rode on and on, continually mistaking bushes for trees and gullies for men, and continually discovering his mistakes. Having descended the hill at a trot, he no longer saw either our own or the enemy's fires, but heard the shouting of the French more loudly and distinctly. In the valley he saw before him something like a river, but when he reached it, he found it was a road. Having come out onto the road, he reined in his horse, hesitating whether to ride along it or cross it and ride over the black field up the hillside. To keep to the road, which gleamed white in the mist, would have been safer, because it would be easier to see people coming along it.
"Follow me," said he,
crossed the road, and began riding up the hill at a gallop, toward the point where the French pickets had been standing that evening.
"Your Honour, there he is," cried one of the hussars behind him, and before Rostov had time to make out what the black thing was that had suddenly appeared in the fog, there was a flash followed by a report and a bullet whizzing high up in the mist with a plaintive sound passed out of hearing. Another musket missed fire, but flashed in the pan. Rostov turned his horse and galloped back. Four more reports followed at intervals, and the bullets passed somewhere in the fog, singing in different tones. Rostov reined in his horse, whose spirits had risen like his own at the firing, and went back at a footpace.
"Well, some more, some more," a merry voice was saying in his soul. But no more shots came. Only when approaching Bagration did Rostov let his horse gallop again, and with his hand at the salute rode up to the general. Dolgorukov was still insisting that the French had retreated and had only lit fires to deceive us. "What does that prove?" he was saying as Rostov rode up. "They might retreat and leave the pickets."
"It's plain that they have not all gone yet, Prince," said Bagration. "Wait till tomorrow morning. We'll find out everything tomorrow morning."
"The picket is still on the hill, Your Excellency, just where it was in the evening," reported Rostov, stooping forward with his hand at the salute, and unable to repress the smile of delight induced by his ride, and especially by the sound of the bullets.
"Very good, very good," said Bagration. "Thank you, officer."
"Your Excellency," said Rostov, "may I ask a favour?"
"What is it?"
"Tomorrow our squadron is to be in reserve. May I ask to be attached to the first squadron?"
"What's your name?"
"Count Rostov."
"Oh, very well. You may stay in attendance on me."
"Count Ilya Rostov's son?" asked Dolgorukov.
But Rostov did not reply.
"Then I may reckon on it, Your Excellency?"
"I will give the order."
"Tomorrow, very likely, I may be sent with some message to the Emperor," thought Rostov. "Thank God!"
The fires and shouting in the enemy's army were occasioned by the fact that while Napoleon's proclamation was being read to the troops, the Emperor himself rode round his bivouacs. The soldiers, on seeing him, lit wisps of straw and ran after him, shouting, "Vive l'Empereur!"
Napoleon's proclamation was as follows. Soldiers, the Russian army is advancing against you to avenge the Austrian army of Ulm. They are the same battalions you broke at Hollerbrunn and have pursued ever since to this place. The position we occupy is a strong one, and while they are marching to go round me on the right, they will expose a flank to me. Soldiers, I will myself direct your battalions. I will keep out of fire if you, with your habitual valour, carry disorder and confusion into the enemy's ranks. But should victory be in doubt even for a moment, you will see your emperor exposing himself to the first blows of the enemy. For there must be no doubt of victory, especially on this day, when what is at stake is the honour of the French infantry, so necessary to the honour of our nation. Do not break your ranks on the plea of removing the wounded. Let every man be fully imbued with the thought that we must defeat these hirelings of England, inspired by such hatred of our nation. This victory will conclude our campaign, and we can return to winter quarters where fresh troops who are being raised in France will join us. And the peace I shall conclude will be worthy of my people, of you, and of myself. Napoleon.
Chapter 14. The Battle of Austerlitz. At 5 in the morning it was still quite dark. The troops of the centre, the reserves, and Bagration's right flank had not yet moved, but on the left flank the columns of infantry, cavalry, and artillery, which were to be the first to descend the heights to attack the French right flank and drive it into the Bohemian mountains according to plan, were already up and astir. The smoke of the campfires, into which they were throwing everything superfluous, made the eyes smart. It was cold and dark. The officers were hurriedly drinking tea and breakfasting, the soldiers munching biscuit and beating a tattoo with their feet to warm themselves, gathering round the fires, throwing into the flames the remains of sheds, chairs, tables, wheels, tubs, and everything they did not want or could not carry away with them. Austrian column guides were moving in and out among the Russian troops and served as heralds of the advance. As soon as an Austrian officer showed himself near a commanding officer's quarters, the regiment began to move. The soldiers ran from the fires, thrust their pipes into their boots, their bags into the carts, got their muskets ready and formed rank. The officers buttoned up their coats, buckled on their swords and pouches, and moved along the ranks, shouting. The train drivers and orderlies harnessed and packed the wagons and tied on the loads. The adjutants and battalion and regimental commanders mounted, crossed themselves, gave final instructions, orders, and commissions to the baggage men who remained behind, and the monotonous tramp of thousands of feet resounded. The column moved forward without knowing where, and unable from the masses around them, the smoke and the increasing fog, to see either the place they were leaving or that to which they were going. A soldier on the march is hemmed in and borne along by his regiment as much as a sailor is by his ship. However far he has walked, whatever strange, unknown, and dangerous places he reaches, just as a sailor is always surrounded by the same decks, masts, and rigging of his ship, so the soldier always has around him the same comrades, the same rank, the same Sergeant Major Ivan Mitrich, the same company dog Jack, and the same commanders. The sailor rarely cares to know the latitude in which his ship is sailing, but on the day of battle, heaven knows how and whence, a stern note of which all are conscious sounds in the moral atmosphere of an army, announcing the approach of something decisive and solemn, and awakening in the men an unusual curiosity. On the day of battle, the soldiers excitedly try to get beyond the interests of their regiment. They listen intently, look about, and eagerly ask concerning what is going on around them. The fog had grown so dense that though it was growing light, they could not see 10 paces ahead. Bushes looked like gigantic trees, and level ground like cliffs and slopes. Anywhere, on any side, one might encounter an enemy invisible 10 paces off.
But the columns advanced for a long time, always in the same fog, descending and ascending hills, avoiding gardens and enclosures, going over new and unknown ground, and nowhere encountering the enemy. On the contrary, the soldiers became aware that in front, behind, and on all sides, other Russian columns were moving in the same direction. Every soldier felt glad to know that to the unknown place where he was going, many more of our men were going too. "There now, the Kurskis have also gone past," was being said in the ranks. "It's wonderful what a lot of our troops have gathered, lads. Last night I looked at the campfires and there was no end of them. A regular Moscow." Though none of the column commanders rode up to the ranks or talked to the men, the commanders, as we saw at the Council of War, were out of humour and dissatisfied with the affair, and so did not exert themselves to cheer the men, but merely carried out the orders. Yet the troops marched gaily, as they always do when going into action, especially to an attack. But when they had marched for about an hour in the dense fog, the greater part of the men had to halt, and an unpleasant consciousness of some dislocation and blunder spread through the ranks. How such a consciousness is communicated is very difficult to define, but it certainly is communicated very surely, and flows rapidly, imperceptibly, and irrepressibly, as water does in a creek. Had the Russian army been alone without any allies, it might perhaps have been a long time before this consciousness of mismanagement became a general conviction. But as it was, the disorder was readily and naturally attributed to the stupid Germans, and everyone was convinced that a dangerous muddle had been occasioned by the sausage-eaters. "Why have we stopped? Is the way blocked? Or have we already come up against the French?" "No, one can't hear them. They'd be firing if we had. They were in a hurry enough to start us, and now here we stand in the middle of a field without rhyme or reason. It's all those damned Germans muddling. What stupid devils. Yes, I'd send them on in front, but no fear, they're crowding up behind. And now here we stand, hungry. I say, shall we soon be clear? They say the cavalry are blocking the way," said an officer. "Oh, those damned Germans. They don't know their own country," said another. "What division are you?" shouted an adjutant, riding up. "The 18th. "Then why are you still here? You should have gone on long ago. Now you won't get there till evening." "What stupid orders. They don't themselves know what they're doing," said the officer, and rode off. A general rode past, shouting something angrily, not in Russian. "Toffer loffer! But what he's jabbering, no one can make out," said a soldier, mimicking the general who had ridden away. "I'd shoot 'em, the scoundrels." "We were ordered to be at the place before 9, but we haven't got halfway." "Fine orders," was being repeated on different sides. And the feeling of energy with which the troops had started began to turn into vexation and anger at the stupid arrangements and at the Germans. The cause of the confusion was that while the Austrian cavalry was moving toward our left flank, the higher command found that our centre was too far separated from our right flank, and the cavalry were all ordered to turn back to the right. Several thousand cavalry crossed in front of the infantry, who had to wait. At the front, an altercation occurred between an Austrian guide and a Russian general. The general shouted a demand that the cavalry should be halted. The Austrian argued that not he, but the higher command, was to blame. The troops, meanwhile, stood growing listless and dispirited. After an hour's delay, they at last moved on, descending the hill. The fog that was dispersing on the hill lay still more densely below, where they were descending. In front, in the fog, a shot was heard, and then another. At first irregularly, at varying intervals, tra-ta-tat, and then more and more regularly and rapidly, and the action at the Goldbach stream began. Not expecting to come on the enemy down by the stream, and having stumbled on him in the fog, hearing no encouraging word from their commanders, and with a consciousness of being too late spreading through the ranks, and above all being unable to see anything in front or around them in the thick fog, the Russians exchanged shots with the enemy lazily, and advanced and again halted, receiving no timely orders from the officers or adjutants who wandered about in the fog in those unknown surroundings, unable to find their own regiments. In this way, the action began for the first, second, and third columns, which had gone down into the valley. The fourth column, with which Kutuzov was, stood on the Pratzen Heights. Below, where the fight was beginning, there was still thick fog. On the higher ground it was clearing, but nothing could be seen of what was going on in front. Whether all the enemy forces were, as we supposed, 6 miles away, or whether they were nearby in that sea of mist, no one knew till after 8 o'clock. It was 9 o'clock in the morning. The fog lay unbroken like a sea down below, but higher up at the village of Schlapanitz, where Napoleon stood with his marshals around him, it was quite light. Above him was a clear blue sky, and the sun's vast orb quivered like a huge hollow crimson float on the surface of that milky sea of mist. The whole French army, and even Napoleon himself with his staff, were not on the far side of the streams and hollows of Sokolnitz and Schlapanitz, beyond which we intended to take up our position and begin the action, but were on this side, so close to our own forces that Napoleon with the naked eye could distinguish a mounted man from one on foot. Napoleon, in the blue cloak which he had worn on his Italian campaign, sat on his small grey Arab horse a little in front of his marshals. He gazed silently at the hills, which seemed to rise out of the sea of mist, and on which the Russian troops were moving in the distance, and he listened to the sounds of firing in the valley. Not a single muscle of his face, which in those days was still thin, moved. His gleaming eyes were fixed intently on one spot. His predictions were being justified. Part of the Russian force had already descended into the valley, toward the ponds and lakes, and part were leaving these Pratzen Heights, which he intended to attack and regarded as the key to the position. He saw over the mist that in a hollow between two hills, near the village of Pratzen, the Russian columns, their bayonets glittering, were moving continuously in one direction toward the valley and disappearing one after another into the mist. From information he had received the evening before, from the sound of wheels and footsteps heard by the outposts during the night, by the disorderly movement of the Russian columns, and from all indications, he saw clearly that the Allies believed him to be far away in front of them, and that the columns moving near Pratzen constituted the centre of the Russian army, and that that centre was already sufficiently weakened to be successfully attacked. But still, he did not begin the engagement. Today was a great day for him, the anniversary of his coronation. Before dawn he had slept for a few hours, and refreshed, vigorous, and in good spirits, he mounted his horse and rode out into the field in that happy mood in which everything seems possible and everything succeeds. He sat motionless, looking at the heights visible above the mist, and his cold face wore that special look of confident, self-complacent happiness that one sees on the face of a boy happily in love. The marshals stood behind him, not venturing to distract his attention. He looked now at the Pratzen Heights, now at the sun floating up out of the mist. When the sun had entirely emerged from the fog, and fields and mist were aglow with dazzling light, as if he had only awaited this to begin the action, he drew the glove from his shapely white hand, made a sign with it to the marshals, and ordered the action to begin. The marshals, accompanied by adjutants, galloped off in different directions, and a few minutes later the chief forces of the French army moved rapidly toward those Pratzen Heights, which were being more and more denuded by Russian troops moving down the valley to their left. Chapter 15. At 8 o'clock, Kutuzov rode to Pratzen at the head of the fourth column, Miloradovich's, the one that was to take the place of Przebyszewski's and Longeron's columns, which had already gone down into the valley. He greeted the men of the foremost regiment and gave them the order to march, thereby indicating that he intended to lead that column himself. When he had reached the village of Pratsen, he halted. Prince Andrei was behind, among the immense number forming the commander-in-chief's suite. He was in a state of suppressed excitement and irritation, though controlledly calm, as a man is, at the approach of a long-awaited moment. He was firmly convinced that this was the day of his Toulon, or his Bridge of Arcola. How it would come about he did not know, but he felt sure it would do so. The locality and the position of our troops were known to him as far as they could be known to anyone in our army. His own strategic plan, which obviously could not now be carried out, was forgotten. Now, entering into Weyrother's plan, Prince Andrei considered possible contingencies and formed new projects such as might call for his rapidity of perception and decision. To the left, down below in the mist, the musketry fire of unseen forces could be heard. It was there Prince Andrei thought the fight would concentrate. There we shall encounter difficulties, and there, thought he, I shall be sent with a brigade or a division, and there, standard in hand, I shall go forward and break whatever is in front of me. He could not look calmly at the standards of the passing battalions. Seeing them, he kept thinking, that may be the very standard with which I shall lead the army. In the morning, all that was left of the night mist on the heights was a hoar frost, now turning to dew, but in the valleys it still lay like a milk-white sea. Nothing was visible in the valley to the left into which our troops had descended, and from whence came the sounds of firing. Above the heights was the dark, clear sky, and to the right the vast orb of the sun. In front, far off on the farther shore of that sea of mist, some wooded hills were discernible, and it was there the enemy probably was, for something could be descried. On the right, the guards were entering the misty region with a sound of hoofs and wheels, and now and then a gleam of bayonets. To the left, beyond the village, similar masses of cavalry came up and disappeared in the sea of mist. In front and behind moved infantry. The commander-in-chief was standing at the end of the village, letting the troops pass by him. That morning Kutuzov seemed worn and irritable. The infantry passing before him came to a halt, without any command being given, apparently obstructed by something in front. "Do order them to form into battalion columns and go round the village," he said angrily to a general who had ridden up. "Don't you understand, Your Excellency, my dear sir, that you must not defile through narrow village streets when we're marching against the enemy?" "I intended to reform them beyond the village, Your Excellency," answered the general. Kutuzov laughed bitterly. "You'll make a fine thing of it, deploying in sight of the enemy. Very fine. The enemy is still far away, Your Excellency. According to the dispositions—" "The dispositions!" exclaimed Kutuzov bitterly. "Who told you that? Kindly do as you are ordered."
"Yes, sir."
"My dear fellow," Nesvitsky whispered to Prince Andrei. "The old man is as surly as a dog." An Austrian officer in a white uniform with green plumes in his hat galloped up to Kutuzov and asked in the Emperor's name if the fourth column had advanced into action. Kutuzov turned round without answering, and his eye happened to fall upon Prince Andrei, who was beside him. Seeing him, Kutuzov's malevolent and caustic expression softened, as if admitting that what was being done was not his adjutant's fault, and still not answering the Austrian adjutant, he addressed Bolkonski. "Go, my dear fellow, and see whether the 3rd Division has passed the village. Tell it to stop and await my orders." Hardly had Prince Andrei started than he stopped him. "And ask whether sharpshooters have been posted," he added. "What are they doing? What are they doing?" he muttered to himself, still not replying to the Austrian. Prince Andrei galloped off to execute the order. Overtaking the battalions that continued to advance, he stopped the 3rd Division and convinced himself that there really were no sharpshooters in front of our columns. The colonel at the head of the regiment was much surprised at the commander-in-chief's order to throw out skirmishers. He had felt perfectly sure that there were other troops in front of him, and that the enemy must be at least 6 miles away. There was really nothing to be seen in front, except a barren descent hidden by dense mist. Having given orders in the commander-in-chief's name to rectify this omission, Prince Andrei galloped back. Kutuzov, still in the same place, his stout body resting heavily in the saddle with the lassitude of age, sat yawning wearily with closed eyes. The troops were no longer moving, but stood with the butts of their muskets on the ground. "All right, all right," he said to Prince Andrei, and turned to a general who, watch in hand, was saying it was time they started, as all the left flank columns had already descended. "Plenty of time, Your Excellency," muttered Kutuzov in the midst of a yawn. "Plenty of time," he repeated. Just then, at a distance behind Kutuzov, was heard the sound of regiments saluting, and this sound rapidly came nearer along the whole extended line of the advancing Russian columns. Evidently the person they were greeting was riding quickly. When the soldiers of the regiment in front of which Kutuzov was standing began to shout, he rode a little to one side and looked round with a frown. Along the road from Pratzen galloped what looked like a squadron of horsemen in various uniforms. Two of them rode side by side in front at full gallop. One, in a black uniform with white plumes in his hat, rode a bob-tailed chestnut horse. The other, who was in a white uniform, rode a black one. These were the two emperors, followed by their suites. Kutuzov, affecting the manners of an old soldier at the front, gave the command, "Attention!" and rode up to the emperors with a salute. His whole appearance and manner were suddenly transformed. He put on the air of a subordinate who obeys without reasoning. With an affectation of respect which evidently struck Alexander unpleasantly, he rode up and saluted. This unpleasant impression merely flitted over the young and happy face of the emperor like a cloud of haze across a clear sky and vanished. After his illness he looked rather thinner that day than on the field of Olmütz, where Bolkonski had seen him for the first time abroad, but there was still the same bewitching combination of majesty and mildness in his fine grey eyes, and on his delicate lips the same capacity for varying expression and the same prevalent appearance of good-hearted, innocent youth. At the Olmütz review he had seemed more majestic. Here he seemed brighter and more energetic. He was slightly flushed after galloping 2 miles, and reining in his horse he sighed restfully and looked round at the faces of his suite, young and animated as his own. Czartoryski, Novosiltsev, Prince Volkonsky, Stroganov, and the others, all richly dressed gay young men on splendid, well-groomed, fresh, only slightly heated horses, exchanging remarks and smiling, had stopped behind the emperor. The Emperor Francis, a rosy, long-faced young man, sat very erect on his handsome black horse, looking about him in a leisurely and preoccupied manner. He beckoned to one of his white-uniformed adjutants and asked some question. "Most likely he is asking at what o'clock they started," thought Prince Andrei, watching his old acquaintance with a smile he could not repress as he recalled his reception at Brünn. In the Emperor's suite were the picked young orderly officers of the Guard and Line regiments, Russian and Austrian. Among them were grooms leading the Tsar's beautiful relay horses, covered with embroidered cloths. As when a window is opened, a whiff of fresh air from the fields enters a stuffy room, so a whiff of youthfulness, energy, and confidence of success reached Kutuzov's cheerless staff with the galloping advent of all these brilliant young men. "Why aren't you beginning, Mikhail Ilarionovich?" said the Emperor Alexander hurriedly to Kutuzov, glancing courteously at the same time at the Emperor Francis. "I am waiting, Your Majesty," answered Kutuzov, bending forward respectfully. The Emperor, frowning slightly, bent his ear forward as if he had not quite heard. "Waiting, Your Majesty," repeated Kutuzov. Prince Andrei noted that Kutuzov's upper lip twitched unnaturally as he said the word waiting. "Not all the columns have formed up yet, Your Majesty." The Tsar heard, but obviously did not like the reply. He shrugged his rather round shoulders and glanced at Novosiltsev, who was near him, as if complaining of Kutuzov. "You know, Mikhail Ilarionovich, we are not on the Empress's field, where a parade does not begin till all the troops are assembled," said the Tsar with another glance at the Emperor Francis, as if inviting him, if not to join in, at least to listen to what he was saying. But the Emperor Francis continued to look about him and did not listen.
"That is just why I do not begin, sire," said Kutuzov in a resounding voice, apparently to preclude the possibility of not being heard, and again something in his face twitched. "That is just why I do not begin, sire, because we are not on parade and not on the Empress's field," he said clearly and distinctly.
In the Emperor's suite all exchanged rapid looks that expressed dissatisfaction and reproach. Old though he may be, he should not, he certainly should not speak like that, their glances seemed to say. The Tsar looked intently and observantly into Kutuzov's eye, waiting to hear whether he would say anything more. But Kutuzov, with respectfully bowed head, seemed also to be waiting. The silence lasted for about a minute.
"However, if you command it, Your Majesty," said Kutuzov, lifting his head and again assuming his former tone of a dull, unreasoning but submissive general.
He touched his horse, and having called Miloradovich, the commander of the column, gave him the order to advance. The troops again began to move, and two battalions of the Novgorod and one of the Apsheron regiment went forward past the Emperor. As this Apsheron battalion marched by, the red-faced Miloradovich, without his greatcoat, with his orders on his breast, and an enormous tuft of plumes in his cocked hat, worn on one side with its corners front and back, galloped strenuously forward, and with a dashing salute reined in his horse before the Emperor.
"God be with you, General," said the Emperor.
"Ma foi, sire! Nous ferons ce qui sera dans notre possibilité, sire,"
he answered gaily, raising nevertheless ironic smiles among the gentlemen of the Tsar's suite by his poor French. Miloradovich wheeled his horse sharply and stationed himself a little behind the Emperor. The Apsheron men, excited by the Tsar's presence, passed in step before the Emperor's and their suites at a bold, brisk pace.
"Lads!" shouted Miloradovich in a loud, self-confident and cheery voice, obviously so elated by the sound of firing, by the prospect of battle, and by the sight of the gallant Apsherons, his comrades in Suvorov's time, now passing so gallantly before the Emperor's, that he forgot the sovereign's presence.
"Lads, it's not the first village you've had to take!" cried he.
"Glad to do our best!"
shouted the soldiers. The Emperor's horse started at the sudden cry. This horse that had carried the sovereign at reviews in Russia bore him also here on the field of Austerlitz, enduring the heedless blows of his left foot and pricking its ears at the sound of shots, just as it had done on the Empress's field, not understanding the significance of the firing, nor of the nearness of the Emperor Francis's black cob, nor of all that was being said, thought, and felt that day by its rider. The Emperor turned with a smile to one of his followers and made a remark to him, pointing to the gallant Apsherons. Chapter 16. Kutuzov, accompanied by his adjutants, rode at a walking pace behind the carabineers. When he had gone less than half a mile in the rear of the column, he stopped at a solitary, deserted house that had probably once been an inn, where two roads parted. Both of them led downhill, and troops were marching along both. The fog had begun to clear, and enemy troops were already dimly visible about a mile and a half off on the opposite heights. Down below, on the left, the firing became more distinct. Kutuzov had stopped and was speaking to an Austrian general. Prince Andrei, who was a little behind looking at them, turned to an adjutant to ask him for a field glass.
"Look! Look!" said this adjutant, looking not at the troops in the distance, but down the hill before him. "It's the French!"
The two generals and the adjutant took hold of the field glass, trying to snatch it from one another. The expression on all their faces suddenly changed to one of horror.
The French were supposed to be a mile and a half away, but had suddenly and unexpectedly appeared just in front of them. It's the enemy? No. Yes, see, it is, for certain. But how is that? Said different voices. With the naked eye, Prince Andrei saw below them to the right, not more than 500 paces from where Kutuzov was standing, a dense French column coming up to meet the Apsherons. Here it is. The decisive moment has arrived. My turn has come, thought Prince Andrei, and striking his horse, he rode up to Kutuzov. The Apsherons must be stopped, Your Excellency, cried he. But at that very instant a cloud of smoke spread all around. Firing was heard quite close at hand, and a voice of naive terror barely two steps from Prince Andrei shouted, Brothers, all's lost! And at this, as if at a command, everyone began to run. Confused and ever-increasing crowds were running back to where 5 minutes before the troops had passed the Emperor's. Not only would it have been difficult to stop that crowd, it was even impossible not to be carried back with it oneself. Bolkonski only tried not to lose touch with it, and looked around bewildered and unable to grasp what was happening in front of him. Nesvitsky, with an angry face, red and unlike himself, was shouting to Kutuzov that if he did not ride away at once he would certainly be taken prisoner. Kutuzov remained in the same place, and without answering drew out a handkerchief. Blood was flowing from his cheek. Prince Andrei forced his way to him. "You are wounded?" he asked, hardly able to master the trembling of his lower jaw. "The wound is not here. It is there," said Kutuzov, pressing the handkerchief to his wounded cheek and pointing to the fleeing soldiers. "Stop them!" he shouted, and at the same moment, probably realizing that it was impossible to stop them, spurred his horse and rode to the right. A fresh wave of the flying mob caught him and bore him back with it. The troops were running in such a dense mass that once surrounded by them it was difficult to get out again. One was shouting, "Get on! Why are you hindering us?" Another in the same place turned round and fired in the air. A third was striking the horse Kutuzov himself rode. Having, by a great effort, got away to the left from that flood of men, Kutuzov, with his suite diminished by more than half, rode toward a sound of artillery fire nearby. Having forced his way out of the crowd of fugitives, Prince Andrei, trying to keep near Kutuzov, saw on the slope of the hill amid the smoke a Russian battery that was still firing, and Frenchmen running toward it. Higher up stood some Russian infantry, neither moving forward to protect the battery nor backward with the fleeing crowd. A mounted general separated himself from the infantry and approached Kutuzov. Of Kutuzov's suite, only four remained. They were all pale and exchanged looks in silence. "Stop those wretches!" gasped Kutuzov to the regimental commander, pointing to the flying soldiers. But at that instant, as if to punish him for those words, bullets flew hissing across the regiment and across Kutuzov's suite like a flock of little birds. The French had attacked the battery, and seeing Kutuzov, were firing at him. After this volley, the regimental commander clutched at his leg. Several soldiers fell, and a second lieutenant who was holding the flag let it fall from his hands. It swayed and fell, but caught on the muskets of the nearest soldiers. The soldiers started firing without orders. "Oh, oh, oh," groaned Kutuzov despairingly and looked round. "Bolkonski," he whispered, his voice trembling from a consciousness of the feebleness of age. "Bolkonski," he whispered, pointing to the disordered battalion and at the enemy. "What's that?" But before he had finished speaking, Prince Andrei, feeling tears of shame and anger choking him, had already leapt from his horse and run to the standard. "Forward, lads!" he shouted in a voice piercing as a child's. "Here it is," thought he, seizing the staff of the standard and hearing with pleasure the whistle of bullets evidently aimed at him. Several soldiers fell. "Hurrah!" shouted Prince Andrei, and scarcely able to hold up the heavy standard, he ran forward with full confidence that the whole battalion would follow him. And really, he only ran a few steps alone. One soldier moved, and then another, and soon the whole battalion ran forward, shouting, "Hurrah!" and overtook him. A sergeant of the battalion ran up and took the flag that was swaying from its weight in Prince Andrei's hands, but he was immediately killed. Prince Andrei again seized the standard, and dragging it by the staff, ran on with the battalion. In front, he saw our artillerymen, some of whom were fighting, while others, having abandoned their guns, were running toward him. He also saw French infantry soldiers, who were seizing the artillery horses and turning the guns round. Prince Andrei and the battalion were already within 20 paces of the cannon. He heard the whistle of bullets above him unceasingly, and to right and left of him soldiers continually groaned and dropped, but he did not look at them. He looked only at what was going on in front of him, at the battery. He now saw clearly the figure of a red-haired gunner with his shako knocked awry, pulling one end of a mop, while a French soldier tugged at the other. He could distinctly see the distraught yet angry expression on the faces of those two men, who evidently did not realize what they were doing. "What are they about?" thought Prince Andrei as he gazed at them. "Why doesn't the red-haired gunner run away as he's unarmed? Why doesn't the Frenchman stab him? He will not get away before the Frenchman remembers his bayonet and stabs him." And really, another French soldier, trailing his musket, ran up to the struggling men, and the fate of the red-haired gunner, who had triumphantly secured the mop and still did not realize what awaited him, was about to be decided. But Prince Andrei did not see how it ended. It seemed to him as though one of the soldiers near him hit him on the head with the full swing of a bludgeon. It hurt a little, but the worst of it was that the pain distracted him and prevented his seeing what he'd been looking at. "What is this? Am I falling? My legs are giving way," thought he, and fell on his back. He opened his eyes, hoping to see how the struggle of the Frenchman with the gunners ended, whether the red-haired gunner had been killed or not, and whether the cannon had been captured or saved. But he saw nothing. Above him, there was now nothing but the sky, the lofty sky, not clear, yet still immeasurably lofty, with grey clouds gliding slowly across it. How quiet, peaceful and solemn. "Not at all as I ran," thought Prince Andrei. "Not as we ran, shouting and fighting. Not at all as the gunner and the Frenchman with frightened and angry faces struggled for the mop. How differently do those clouds glide across that lofty, infinite sky. How was it I did not see that lofty sky before? And how happy I am to have found it at last. Yes, all is vanity, all falsehood, except that infinite sky. There is nothing, nothing but that. But even it does not exist. There is nothing but quiet and peace. Thank God."
Chapter 17. On our right flank, commanded by Bagration, at 9 o'clock the battle had not yet begun. Not wishing to agree to Dolgorukov's demand to commence the action, and wishing to avert responsibility from himself, Prince Bagration proposed to Dolgorukov to send to inquire of the commander-in-chief. Bagration knew that as the distance between the two flanks was more than 6 miles, even if the messenger were not killed, which he very likely would be, and found the commander-in-chief, which would be very difficult, he would not be able to get back before evening. Bagration cast his large, expressionless, sleepy eyes round his suite, and the boyish face of Rostov, breathless with excitement and hope, was the first to catch his eye. He sent him.
"And if I should meet His Majesty before I meet the commander-in-chief, Your Excellency," said Rostov, with his hand to his cap.
"You can give the message to His Majesty," said Dolgorukov, hurriedly interrupting Bagration. On being relieved from picket duty, Rostov had managed to get a few hours' sleep before morning, and felt cheerful, bold, and resolute, with elasticity of movement, faith in his good fortune, and generally in that state of mind which makes everything seem possible, pleasant, and easy. All his wishes were being fulfilled that morning. There was to be a general engagement in which he was taking part. More than that, he was orderly to the bravest general, and still more, he was going with a message to Kutuzov, perhaps even to the sovereign himself.
The morning was bright, he had a good horse under him, and his heart was full of joy and happiness. On receiving the order, he gave his horse the rein and galloped along the line. At first he rode along the line of Bagration's troops, which had not yet advanced into action but were standing motionless. Then he came to the region occupied by Uvarov's cavalry, and here he noticed a stir and signs of preparation for battle. Having passed Uvarov's cavalry,